Speaking at the memorial on Tuesday, President Obama said the Islamic faith is not to blame for Nidal Malik Hassan's shooting spree at Fort Hood.
No faith justifies these murderous and craven acts. No just and loving God looks upon them with favor. For what he has done, we know that the killer will be met with justice in this world and the next.
But as more evidence emerges, it seems the military could have identified Hassan as a risk last year. Or could they? You want a name, someone to blame. You need a name. Hassan's lawyer says he can't possibly get a fair trial. Will the military get a fair shake? Or is Congress just looking for someone to blame? Finding fault where it lies on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 12th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Celeste. Coming up this hour, the disturbing background of Major Hassan is coming into focus now. Also, we learn a new word, biomechatronics. It's all about state-of-the-art prosthetics for Iraq vets. And your money or your rights, budget crunches in Georgia hurting indigent defendants.
But first, Scott Shane joins us. He's the national security reporter for the New York Times. Scott, there seems to be increasing evidence that somebody dropped the ball when it came to identifying some potentially disturbing behavior by the suspected Fort Hood shooter, Major Nidal Malik Hassan. Who was at fault here?
Well, there are two places that I think investigators are going to be looking at. One is the fact that Major Hassan had sent some emails to a radical cleric in Yemen in late 2008, and those emails were captured and analyzed, and the decision was made that they didn't represent any threat. So there may be some second-guessing on that point. And the other is his colleagues at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, some of whom thought that he showed alarming views of the war and alarming views of whether Muslims should participate in the war, and some even raised questions about his demeanor and perhaps his mental stability.
Is there a failure on the part of these agencies to communicate properly with each other?
Well, I think right now there's a lot of finger-pointing and a lot of leaping to conclusions. It's probably going to take a much more measured assessment of all those, of both those areas, to decide whether there was really fault somewhere or whether, in fact, this was not necessarily preventable.
Okay, Scott Shane, stay with us. We're going to talk more about that in just a few minutes. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
It's back to the drawing board. President Obama has rejected his national security team's proposals for a new strategy in Afghanistan. The president reportedly wants clear answers on how and when U.S. troops would hand over responsibilities to the Afghan government. It comes as the U.S. ambassador in Kabul wrote to the president arguing against sending thousands of more troops to the region. Carl Eikenberry, a former U.S. military commander in Afghanistan, says there are concerns about corruption within the Afghan government. Senior United Nations official Richard Barrett agrees.
What goes on in Afghanistan remains 90% military and only 10% political, and I think that has to change.
It's something the president will be thinking about as he embarks today on a 9-day trip to Asia. He'll head first to Tokyo before a stop in Singapore for the Asia-Pacific Economic Summit, followed by a 3-day visit to China.
And the group Human Rights Watch says the Chinese government is operating secret jails. Their report accuses Chinese agents of kidnapping citizens on their way to lodge complaints against the government. Back at home, as we've been hearing new details on accused Fort Hood gunman Major Nidal Malik Hassan, officials held meetings last year where they discussed whether or not he was psychotic. The Dow posted its sixth straight gain, finishing up 44 points yesterday. The S&P 500 rose 5.5 points to finish at a 13-month high, and the Nasdaq was up slightly as well. President Obama is heading to Asia, and this time he's going to tackle a very huge problem, the superpower China. And we're looking, how do you define the relationship with China? Will China eventually rule the world? That's our question to you. What do you think? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
More evidence is emerging about what officials knew about Nidal Malik Hassan before the shooting at Fort Hood and what they did not know. It seems U.S. intelligence officials knew that the suspected Fort Hood shooter was exchanging emails with a very radicalized cleric in Yemen.
I mean, this is a whole, what did they know, when did they know it, could it have possibly prevented the tragedy at Fort Hood last week?
And perhaps, why were they not talking to one another? Because the other thing that is being reported by our friend Scott Shane at the New York Times is that his colleagues, Hassan's colleagues at Walter Reed, knew that he was becoming increasingly unstable. So 8 years after 9/11, supposedly taught our law enforcement agencies that they need to share information. Why didn't these two groups communicate this information with each other? Scott Shane, National Security Reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Can you answer that? Have we not learned? Is this a question of the fact that this was nobody on either end was alarmed enough to call attention to put up the red flags? Or is this that we haven't learned the lessons of 9/11 and they're not communicating with one another?
Well, some of the folks that I talked to yesterday pointed out that, in fact, the system worked up to a point. They intercepted these emails so that they actually got hold of these emails. And instead of dumping them in a database somewhere, they actually did pass them on to a terrorism task force. They assigned someone to assess them. That person, again, didn't set it aside. He pulled Hassan's personnel file, records of his work at Walter Reed. But apparently one of the issues, and we don't know the contents of the emails exactly, but we've been told that they were largely questions, not comments, not expressions of extreme views, not certainly no hints that he had any violent acts in mind, but questions about Islamic interpretation. And that the cleric, whose name is Anwar al-Awlaki, wrote back a couple times, but in a very non-committal way, nothing inflammatory, not encouraging Hassan to take any act. So the judgment was made at the time, and I guess eventually when we see the emails and so on, we'll be able to make our own judgments, that it wasn't alarming. He also discovered that this seemed to be in line with research that Hassan was conducting. So there seemed to be an innocent explanation for those communications.
Okay, and very quickly, what the questions among his colleagues at Walter Reed Medical Center was whether or not he was psychotic and fit for duty?
Well, I think there's actually quite a range of views among those colleagues. Some thought he was okay. Some were alarmed at his increasingly outspoken views against the war and against the participation of American Muslims in the war. But their concerns were never passed on to the guy who was examining the emails, and they never learned of the existence of the emails.
Right.
So it's true that those two halves of the puzzle were never put together.
Okay. Scott Shane, thanks. He's the New York Times national security correspondent. So at this point, the legal process begins. And to explain how this legal process works, what happens with Major Nidal Hassan now, we have Eugene Fidel. He teaches military law at Yale Law School. He's also president of the National Institute of Military Justice and joins us from Connecticut. Good morning, Eugene.
Hi, Celeste.
So explain, take us through this process. Once the major gets out of the hospital, where does he go?
Into confinement. I have no question but that he'll be put in pretrial confinement, which is provided for under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, or UCMJ. And just as a sort of first step in thinking about this, which jurisdiction would handle these charges?
You mean civilian or military?
Civilian or military, and state versus federal civilian. Personally, I think the center of gravity of this case is in the military setting. I don't have any doubt about that, and I think that it will be ultimately handled one way or another by the military justice system.
So, Eugene Fidel, I read a commentary from someone saying, look, this was a military officer who took a violent act against other military personnel on a military base. There's no question this will be a military trial. Is that accurate?
That's what I think.
Okay, so does the defendant have any say in where he gets tried?
No.
None at all?
None at all. I mean, his lawyers could try to make an argument that the case should be tried in the civilian federal courts.
But that holds no water.
I don't see any purpose in their doing that. I think it would be a wash as a practical matter. And the person can be tried by both the state and the military. There's no double jeopardy problem there. There's a slight legal issue as to whether the state would have jurisdiction here, depending on how the government happens to hold the piece of property on which...
Whether it's federal land.
Whether it's exclusive federal land.
The other question I had is that his lawyer appears to already be establishing as much as he can that Major Hassan is going to have a very tough time getting a fair trial. Is this his argument to try and move the venue of this trial?
Personally, I think there will be a change of venue. I just, it's a very unusual set of facts. A lot of people have been killed and injured here. I'm not making a judgment about ultimate legal guilt, incidentally. People will form their own conclusions. But I think that it would be very wise of the military to simply move the venue. Yeah.
Now, what is the procedure if it were to go to civilian trial? I mean, under what circumstances? I know it's probably not going to happen, but this jurisdictional question is kind of interesting. I mean, if, for example, one or more of the people killed were civilians, would there be any option to go to a civilian court in addition? And does the military have the ability to explicitly waive jurisdiction and put it into federal court on their own?
Yes. There's actually an agreement between the Department of Justice and the Defense Department. It goes back many years about how these things get resolved. And, there can be a conversation about it if you have a case that's sort of iffy as to which jurisdiction it should go to. The fact that there are civilians in the picture is sort of an atmospheric thing. It doesn't have particular legal significance. However, it is a federal crime to murder a member of the armed forces or other federal official when they're acting in the line of duty. So that would be a potential hook for taking the case into federal court. But again, I don't think that's going to happen.
So, Eugene, I have read several places that there seems to be no question that the death penalty is at least going to be considered here. How common is it for an officer of the rank of major to be in this kind of case facing the death penalty, possibly facing the death penalty?
I've never heard of it happening.
Wow.
Ever.
Correct.
Okay, Eugene Fidel teaches military law at the Yale Law School. He's also president of the National Institute of Military Justice. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's take a look at the top headlines now.
Well, President Obama wants more options as he considers the next step in Afghanistan. A senior aide says the president has rejected all his national security team's proposals, Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador in Kabul has written to the White House arguing against sending more troops to the country. In a leaked letter, Ambassador Carl Eikenberry expressed doubts about the competence of the Afghan government. It's unclear whether Eikenberry's comments have contributed to President Obama's decision to reject the current options. Back home, there's word the Fort Hood shooting suspect, as we mentioned, Major Nidal Malik Hassan, was a cause of concern to the doctors overseeing his medical training. They said he had zealous religious views and was behaving strangely, but they discounted him as a violent threat.
Overseas, Human Rights Watch says the Chinese authorities are operating hundreds of illegal jails where people are imprisoned for attempting to complain about local injustices. President Obama visits China on Sunday. It's not clear whether he'll raise this or any other human rights issues. Back at home, CNN's Lou Dobbs told viewers he's quitting his nightly show to pursue new opportunities. He announced his decision live last night.
I'm the last of the original anchors here on CNN, and I'm proud to have had the privilege of helping to build the world's first news network.
That's one of the original cable news networks. Dobbs began working at CNN in 1980. An announcement on his replacement is expected today. And that's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, bailed out banks are upping their PR campaigns, trying to up charitable donations to give themselves a better reputation across the United States. We'll see if that's working in just a few minutes with Louise Story.
It's not much of a business model, giving away money to make people like you, but it does give you friends.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.